You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to help you plan that unbelievable travel experience. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Talking About podcast. I am your host, Daniel Olinger, joined, as always, by Sean Kennedy. And second in a week in a row, I think maybe fifth out of our last eight podcasts, we have a guest, Sean.
Well, when you get Peter Dinwiddie into your front office, you have to bring somebody on the pod that can talk to his background, because everyone out there, they need more Dinwiddie in their lives. And yeah, we're happy to have Tony East, so I'll let you introduce him real quick.
Yeah, Tony, he covers the Indiana Pacers for Forbes Sports, and he is a host of the Locked On Pacers podcast, which he may or may not be recording after recording with us tonight. Very glad that Tony was willing to do this with us. Tony, introduce yourself.
Yeah, guys, sorry I made you move around your times today.
Oh, no, you're fine.
Yeah, always glad to talk Pacers, and when Peter Dinwiddie left the Pacers, I talked about it on my podcast and made a graphic for him. And I was like, wow, I'm probably the first person who made a graphic for the assistant vice president of basketball operations in the history of basketball Twitter. So excited to talk about him and all things Pacers and Sixers.
Yes. So for those of you who haven't heard, Peter Dinwiddie recently hired to the Sixers front office, going to be working under Elton Brand, probably will have a big role within the franchise. We've heard news of the front office collaboration that's been in place, might have some roles being shifted around. And Sean, I know you wrote a piece for Liberty Ballers here about Peter Dinwiddie, like the moves that have been made by the Pacers while under his since he joined their front office. They include did they trade or sign Corey Joseph?
That was a trade in a salary cap dump move by Toronto. And they basically picked him up for the draft rights to Amir Brzezic. I'm probably butchering the last name there. But it was, yeah, just one of those, hey, get a quality backup for nothing kind of moves that innovative front offices do.
Yeah, and they've made other great moves, such as drafting Aaron Holiday, which some might say isn't a great move. I'm a big Aaron Holiday fan. I loved how he played this last season. Doug McDermott has kind of had like a career resurgence with the Pacers. They seem to have hit a pretty good chord with the Domantas Sabonis extension. Still a lot to go with that, but he had a really good year this past year. They were able to get Malcolm Brogdon. And, of course, most importantly, they got the one, the only TJ McConnell. Stole him from the Sixers. The most beloved point guard in the history of basketball. But, yeah, Tony, what could you tell us about Peter Dinwiddie? Like, some things about his background, just whatever you know about him, because you probably know a lot more about him than us.
Yeah, I don't know how much of this has seeped over to Sixers coverage, Sixers Twitter, whatever. Peter Dinwiddie started with the Pacers in the ticket office, actually, so he has a law degree, but then came to the Pacers, and again, so he was with the ticket office and built his way all the way up into the front office from non-basketball ops roles. And that law degree is what he used when he was studying the CBA to get there, right? So really his journey up through the Pacers was really long, and he's from Indy originally. I think part of that's why he came back to do this job, but I think that's the coolest part about his rise to being a big contributor with the Pacers front office is that he didn't start in a basketball ops role or like lower level basketball or anything like that. He just worked his way through tickets, and Larry Bird, of all people, was the one who was like, wow, this guy's a really smart guy and a hard worker, and got him into the front office a long time ago, a long time being this decade, but everything's a long time ago, it feels like, these days. pulled him into the front office, and he's worked his way through there to being number three. I forget his exact title, something VP of basketball operations. For you guys, he's executive VP. But, yeah, really just a very interesting story and a very interesting group of, you know, Larry Bird picking you up into the front office and then Kevin Pritchard promoting you. Like, just a very interesting group of events to get to where he is now.
So, Tony, here in Philadelphia, we often joke about our collaborative front office, and over the past few years, no one has really known who the primary decision maker is in a lot of things. I think in Indiana, it's a little more clear cut. You have Kevin Pritchard. He's the guy where, you know, the buck kind of stops there. What do you know about maybe any areas of focus Dinwiddie had in the front office, or any moves that have been made where they directed, like, oh, this was him kind of leading the effort, maybe?
Well, he is a lot of modeling and the cap guy. So I mentioned the CBA and his law degree earlier kind of intentionally, because that was his expertise, was the cap and all those rules. And, like, that sounds like something every GM should know, but, like, remember when Magic Johnson got his job with Lakers, he had to, like, study that stuff for, like, a year, right? He had to go to, like, a class and stuff, you know? It's
We were told he went to class.
yeah, exactly. So, you know, him knowing that stuff really well is always really important. And, it's funny, there was a Wish TV, which is the local, I think, NBC, like, news affiliate here in Indy, and they did a story on Peter Dinwiddie. And he was sitting at his desk, like half the story, with Excel sheets in the background, which was super funny. But yeah, he's the cap guy. And as you laid out, and I have it pulled up now, your article kind of outlining some of the moves since he got promoted to the number three. You know, a lot of their big moves have been stuff that's like picking up Darren Collison from his old team that doesn't want him on a value deal. And like, oh, the Wizards can't sign Bojan without going to the tax. Okay, we'll get him on a value deal. Stuff like that, that he, you know, looks around the league, does that modeling for all those teams and knows the rules and the cap space stuff well enough to help the Pacers and help Pritchard, you know, set up the team to get these good deals all the time.
As a salary cap expert, do you think he looks at, like, the Sixers' current salary cap situation and, like, does he, like, twitch or quiver? Does he want to vomit?
Probably, yeah. I don't think he would have liked to give either Horford or Harris the kind of money they got. Now, the Sixers did not have a lot of options, so it kind of made sense at the time, but, you know, that doesn't always matter in retrospect. Yeah, not the best. So, yeah, I'm not sure what he thinks about that, but I'm glad he got a promotion. He deserves it. Well, the deal for him is that he's number two now for the Philly front office, right, instead of number three?
Yeah, he's the number two behind Elton.
Okay.
Correct.
Yeah, so I think that's a good spot for him to, and it'll be cool for his cat brain and his, you know, whatever, I don't know what to call it. It's not analytics, but modeling in the cap sense, brain to try to figure out, like, okay, how can we get out of this? What can we do to move some of this stuff away?
So in how you're describing it, I kind of picture him as like one of those experts that goes into a hoarder's den. And it's like, how can we get this house looking like a normal house again? And he sees the Sixers as one of those challenges where, like, piles of garbage are actually unwanted contracts.
Yeah, exactly. He's good at the bargain stuff, which honestly the Sixers need like crazy, right? They just, any capable dribbling player, please come play on our bench.
I also cover Northwestern basketball for Inside NU, and they had a rough season this past year, and I mentioned on a podcast, a different podcast about a month ago, how it's weird the two teams I cover, the Sixers and Northwestern, both their weaknesses were that they didn't have a player who could pass, dribble, and shoot. All like they didn't have one player who could do all three, like at least average. Like, you know, just it's amazing that the
core basic basketball activities
that like just there was no like. Small creator who can also be a shooting threat. Just the fact that it just doesn't exist on either team. It's just really amazing.
See, the fact that Shake Milton got as many minutes as he did speaks to the lack of a player who can do it. Not that Shake Milton isn't good. Shake Milton's good, but you know, the undrafted or whatever drafted 54th guy is the best at being able to do all those three things. Says a lot. But yeah, I think Peter Dinwiddie can come try to clean some of that stuff up and hopefully not poach any players from the Pacers in the process of doing so.
I will trade you. I will convince the Sixers to trade you back like our next three first unprotected picks for TJ McConnell. I want him back that badly.
He would really help right now too. So that's funny.
TJ McConnell does good things.
He does. Tony, how would you assess his first year in Indiana? I mean, we watched a few games, you know, when the Sixers played him, but what did you think in your first TJ year?
I don't want to get too, like, eyes popping out of my head for the regular season, because in the playoffs, his minutes went down every game, and then in the last game, he didn't play at all. He got cut from the rotation. So he has his limitations, and I need to remember that when assessing him going forward, right? Maybe he isn't quite the – maybe he's an 82-game player. I don't know. But he did good stuff in the playoffs for the Sixers, so could have just been a weird matchup. But, yeah, it's, the first three games of the season, McConnell was bad, like really bad. And then he was awesome for the rest of the season, and he was like, yeah, I just had to figure out how to play with these dudes. And I can't explain it. Like, every time I have someone who covers their team on my podcast to, like, preview a game or something like that, they're always like, TJ McConnell always kills us. You know what I mean? Because you just don't expect it. He's just a 6-foot-tall dude who isn't that athletic, and he just tries really hard and is super fast when he can dribble. And that's a really important skill, is being fast with the ball. So he just probes his way into the lane and creates shots and out of any situation, like against a zone, against man, full court press, doesn't matter. He's going to fly around long enough to get someone a decent shot, which is such a valuable skill. And it was awesome to watch him and the Pacers second unit be one of their better units, just because he just doesn't stop running around.
No, TJ, like, my experience of TJ goes back so far. I remember him first playing those 2015-2016 seasons, and I remember I would joke to, like, my friends, like, I can't believe the Sixers start the most unathletic point guard in NBA history. And I was thinking, oh, man, this guy sucks. I had been a big Aaron Kraft fan in college when he played.
On purpose?
And I was like, Aaron Kraft, like, why couldn't Aaron Kraft do this? But then as I kept watching TJ McConnell, he kept doing – I started to notice, like, wait a second. Like, he's doing everything he needs to do. He's so good at all these things. He's not a bad player. And then he eventually added that little mid-range shot. And then for some reason, his minutes always go down in the playoffs. I know he's not – he can be a little bit of a target because he's a smaller player and he's not really a three-point threat at all. So that kind of lends itself to not wanting to play him in the playoffs. But, I mean, generally the Sixers played better when he was out there. He basically won their only game of the Celtics semifinal series 2 years ago. He was the, like, sole reason they won that game and almost got them back into that series just because he was a terror. Like, he was playing possessed in, like, those two – game five of that series. He wanted it so bad. And I just have such an affinity for the kind of guy where it's like, you can see he's obviously way more athletic than most of us will ever be, but you can see he's not that special of an athlete. He's not even a great shooter, not even a ton of skills despite having a lot of them, but he just finds a way to make it work, and he's turned into a really good NBA player.
It's funny because you say that about, you know, you feel like he's doing well in the playoffs. After the first game they had against the Heat, we talked about adjustments they can make, right? They lost by only 9. It didn't feel like they were about to get swept. You know, they played decent, not great. But I said, yeah, I think they should play McConnell a little bit more, right? Like, he played pretty good with the bench. I think he was, like, +2 or +3. Again, second unit was good, something that was a mainstay for the Pacers all season. Like, keep him out there, keep his energy going, never let it slow down. And the next game he was awful and played, like, 8 minutes. And I was like, well, damn, I'm stupid. But it's just one of those things. It's like, it's so hard to, I guess I'm only using 4 games and like 30 minutes of playing time to evaluate it, but it was so interesting because at first I thought he needed to play more, and then I thought he was bad and shouldn't play at all. It was very flip-floppy. But yeah, I do remember that Celtics series 2 years ago, I can't remember now, but
yeah, it was 3 years ago.
Yeah, so. 3 years ago. So, yeah, that's right. That was the first time making the semis with Embiid. That's right. So yeah, I know he can do it, and he's a joy to watch, and possibly the best locker room presence a team could have. You know, I've never heard him. I mean, it's the locker room. They're not gonna talk crap about their teammates, but always has nice things to say about, you know, every player, every coach, everyone in the organization. Just overall, good dude to have on a team.
Yeah. TJ has very high approval ratings. I know he was pretty good friends with Joel. They would play video games together, they said. And although I do know other point guards on, like, ho-hum regular season nights don't appreciate him that much. I know there's the one story of D'Angelo Russell during a game, like, TJ checks in and goes straight up to the baseline, is full on hugging D'Angelo, won't let him get the ball. And he goes, come on, T, not tonight. I just want to get my run in or something like that. I love that story.
He's just a pass, man. That would make me so mad. Especially because he, like, regardless of score, you know, like, I don't know how I got cut as a sophomore in high school, but like I played enough basketball as a kid to have played in games where it was like, if you're winning by X amount of points, you're like not supposed to press. Like it's a rule of kids leagues, you know?
Yeah.
And then you get to the NBA and TJ McConnell's like, oh, we're up by 10. Nah, I'm gonna steal it from you. And he did it against the Sixers in the bubble, that first game when TJ Warren went off, but he did it against the Sixers. And I remember a bunch of Pacers media people were like, how does Sixers not know he's going to do this? He just did this for them for like 4 years in a row.
Joel was very pissed off at his guards in that game, and he pointed at TJ like, you know, he does this.
Yeah,
like,
he didn't. it was Shake, right?
Yeah,
yeah. That was like part because they were fighting that game too. I remember that now.
Yes, there may have been a threaten of a slap, but you know, apparently all families do that. At least the Sixers families do that.
Oh gosh. Is that what the spin was on that? I never really followed up on that.
That was what I think Brett Brown said after the game. He's like, you know, families fight sometimes. Like, yes, the casual Thanksgiving dinner where I threatened to slap my uncle.
I actually had some replies on social media that people said, like, oh, I have had that happen to Thanksgiving. I'm like, right, you know, different people, you know, they have different life experiences, I guess. But, yeah, speaking of that TJ Warren explosion, I wanted to ask you about that, Tony. So that 50 dropped 53, and then he actually like followed up and had a few really great games after that. So it wasn't a one hit wonder. And Warren originally coming to Indiana, that was another one of those cap maneuvers that maybe Dinwiddie had a hand in, where Phoenix was trying to clear cap space and they actually got assets to take on Warren, who's still on a really affordable deal for a couple more years. So how much of that the couple weeks was expected? Like, were there signs that he was going to break out at all? I mean, not dropping 50, but yeah, what did you think about Warren's growth this past year?
I did not ever expect 50 from him, especially because Nate McMillan is like a share the ball coach. So I never would have thought that one guy would be like that for him. I think the highest that we've seen under McMillan ever was Oladipo at like 44, with irrelevant. Yeah. So in quarantine, TJ Warren went back to North Carolina, where he's from, and he said when in interviews, he's like, all he does like in his life, like even when he doesn't have to practice, he'll like scrimmage or like find friends to play basketball. Dude just loves playing. He was like, I couldn't play against other people because of COVID, so I just shot a bunch of threes and worked on my three ball, and they get to the bubble, and then someone asked Doug McDermott, like, hey, who stands out to you from after quarantine who looks good? He's like, dude, TJ Warren is shooting from absurdly far away and looks awesome. So we get to the first game, you know, and these are like the classic media PR answers, you know, you report on it, but don't make anything of it. And then it actually happens where TJ Warren is pulling up in Ben Simmons' face from 30 feet and is impossible to guard from anywhere. I mean, he's always been a good mid-range scorer, but he added the three and all of a sudden there's literally no way to stop him. I mean, that was just insane. And I've seen him do a lot of good scoring games, right? He had the Pacers, I think, two or three highest games scoring prior to the bubble anyway. So I've seen him, you know, be – one was against the Sixers. He was 15 for 18, but they lost in Philly. But anyway, I've seen him be that good and be a big scorer for the team. But 53, it was just insane. And you know, the pull-ups at the end of the game to put it away. And it was just – I've never seen him like that, where he was just punishing anything. And to carry it – I mean, I don't want to get too far ahead of the question, but to carry it through a few games and then – To start drawing double teams. I mean, it was just a crazy quick transformation.
No, it was, I mean, it was very frustrating watching, like, from our perspective, just like, because some of them were horrible cases of Sixers defense where they gave him open looks. It's like, this guy's red hot, what are you doing? But, like, some of the last shots, it's like, we didn't do anything wrong. They just, he was making everything he threw up. And then, I mean, he had always been good in Phoenix. He could always do that kind of scoring, those types of, like, he had the potential of a three-level scorer. He, like, with his size, his handles, his shot kind of coming along. So it didn't surprise me that he was good on offense this year, but Nate McMillan really did get him to buy in on defense, which he just was not guarding, like, anyone in Phoenix. He let guys go by him all the time, and he really improved on that this year. So,
yep,
I thought that was one of the biggest things for him.
There were some games. So I always talk about this, so you might have heard, I don't know if what you've heard or not heard before, but they went on this Western Conference road trip. They played Portland and Phoenix and Golden State and Denver, I think. So he improved so much as a defender this season that on that road trip, Brogdon missed two games, but he guarded Jamal Murray and then Devin Booker and then D'Angelo Russell and then Damian Lillard. And it's like, Can you imagine, this is January, right? Can you imagine before the season starts being told, like, yeah, they're going to intentionally put TJ Warren on those four guys consecutively on purpose, and it's going to be the best option they have. Like, it was crazy that, and the Pacers do this all the time. I mean, Bojan Bogdanović, still not a good defender, but they turned him from bottom five defender in the NBA to, like, pretty capable.
Oh,
and,
totally.
Yeah, and Doug McDermott's still bad, but, you know, same kind of deal, bottom 10 defender to bottom 50 or 60 defender. And all these rookies that I talked to, and after they joined the Pacers, are like, Dan Burke's gone now. He's an assistant coach. I think Philly fans know about him, actually. I think he said some stuff about Embiid earlier this season. But, yeah, Dan Burke said, is always credited by young guys. They're like, he just teaches me these angles and positions to, like, be a better defender that I've never heard of before. And year after year, these wings come to Indiana, and they get way better at defense. And TJ Warren's just another example. And to combine it with his same offensive output, right? So he's not exerting so much effort on D that he can't score anymore. It just made him such a good player. It was crazy.
Do you think they teach, like, the opposite of those angles in places like Cleveland and Minnesota? Like, no, D'Angelo, open your hips further.
You know what? I just don't get it. Like, how can other teams can watch the Pacers play? You know what I mean? Like, how is this a secret? How does this keep happening year after year? But it does. It's insane. It's so incredible to me. But it might not happen anymore. Dan Burke is a rumored to be on the way out with a new coach, so we'll see.
The 82-game preseason is in the books, and it's finally time for the real season. Don't miss out on any of the NBA playoff action at DraftKings Sportsbook, an official sports betting partner of the NBA. From the play-in tournament through the finals, DraftKings Sportsbook has you covered. Download the DraftKings Sportsbook app and use code SMASH. New customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets instantly. That's code SMASH, only on DraftKings. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER or in West Virginia, visit 1-800-GAMBLER.net. In New York, call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369. In Connecticut, help is available for problem gambling. Call 888-789-7777 or visit ccpg.org. Please play responsibly. On behalf of Boot Hill Casino and Resort in Kansas, 21 and over, age varies by jurisdiction. Void in Ontario. Bonus bets expire 168 hours after issuance. See dkng.co/bball for eligibility and deposit restrictions, terms, and responsible gaming resources.
Listen, I'm 24 and I still live at home. Like, what? For sure. Are you kidding me? My man and I, we attempted to move out.
Yeah, that'll be $1,600 for a studio apartment, not including groceries.
Last fall, the National Association of Realtors released data showing that housing affordability had fallen to its lowest point since the 1980s for reasons of economy, American.
There just aren't a lot of home sales going on. And there's really kind of a standoff right now between buyers and sellers.
That standoff leads to another kind of standoff.
It's always fun being 40-something years old and having to live with your parents again. And I know it's all my fault.
Sir, I don't know your life, but on Today Explained, a two-part series on how it might not be your fault. Our housing reality bites and the American dream is in your childhood bedroom. Series sponsored by Mint Mobile. Today Explained, in your feed every weekday.
And I'll tell my mom, Mom, I'm going to the bathroom, I'll be back. If I'm not out in like 3 minutes, dog, she's like knocking on the door going, everything okay in there? Yeah, Mom, everything's cool, dog.
Well, yes. Speaking of new coaches, Philadelphia obviously has Doc Rivers now replacing Brett Brown, but Indiana coaching overhaul as well. And I wanted to get your insight onto that whole situation because it was just really weird how Nate McMillan got the extension. And then I think it was maybe a week later, maybe a little bit longer, but then he was fired. And I think everyone outside of Indiana was just kind of scratching their heads as to what was going on there.
Well, I don't want to report this because I don't know this for sure, but I want to try to explain it the way that it's kind of been laid out by other people and like loosely reported and stuff. But I think that coaching contracts don't line up with NBA season contracts. And and Nate McMillan had a team option for the coming 2020-21 season. So I think what happened partially is because the games were being played in August, his contract would have actually expired and they had to pick up the team option to have him like coach in the bubble and beyond. I don't know exactly the legality or the timing of how all that worked, but I think that's kind of how it went down. And then Zach Lowe did his podcast with, oh my gosh, I can't remember now.
Stephen Gundy.
Thank you. Yes, when that rumor came out that like they're thinking about swapping McMillan for D'Antoni, and then the Pacers immediately announced it. They're like, okay, no, we don't want this to spread. And Sabonis was out. They knew he was going to be out, so McMillan had his crutch to stay the coach. And then they got just slaughtered by the Heat. I mean, embarrassing. And so apparently there was a conversation between Nate McMillan. This is from McMillan's mouth. He said this, which this is kind of crazy to me. He said to Kevin Pritchard before the season, if I can't get this team out of the first round, like maybe I'm not the right coach for this team. And that's crazy to hear from a coach. Now, as soon as Sabonis wasn't playing, he, you know, he probably knew he couldn't win and had a built-in excuse to stay and keep his job. And I think you guys, me, everybody thought he would keep his job even after that, right? Like Sabonis wasn't playing. The Heat were better. They made the finals, right? They were obviously better. Not a big deal. I mean, you shouldn't get swept, and that's embarrassing. And he went 3-16 in the playoffs with this team, and that's part of why he got fired. But I didn't think he'd get fired. But it makes sense that he ultimately did when you look at it under the spotlight of, okay, the extension was really just picking up his team option because they basically had to, and he's been awful in the playoffs for this team that's had a lot of regular season success. It was time to switch to the next era. So there were a lot of weird things that happened for sure, and it definitely looks pretty awful from the outside with no investigation, but in the really granular level of how it all went down, it kind of makes sense.
No, yeah, I mean, I think that they're, obviously you would know more than I do, but I think that they probably wanted to keep him, but just, it's really hard. These owners and these executives who make decisions, they do not like being embarrassed, and as sad as it is to say, sometimes just missing the playoffs isn't as bad as flaming out in the playoffs in an embarrassing right. way from like a reputation standpoint. I mean, Doc generally did a good job of the Clippers. They were a game away from going to the conference finals, but you blow a 3-1 lead in that fashion, and not only to blow a 3-1 lead, like at least the Jazz, when they blew their 3-1 lead, it felt like they kept all those games close. They just barely missed out on. They were really fighting. The Clippers like laid down. And
yeah, they're up 15 twice.
They just, but once the Nuggets hit them in like game 7, that run came, the yeah. Clippers just died. They were looking around like, who's about to do something about this? And no one did. And I mean, I think part of that is I gave a lot of credit to the Nuggets and everything they persevered through. But also it's just like, you're on national TV in front of millions of people and they're seeing your franchise sputter. And even though it's not as big of a stage in the first round in a series that, while I don't think no one watched the Pacers Heat series, it definitely wasn't like leading the ratings, but
no,
it was just like, but that's the thing. It's like probably the Pacers decision makers are looking at it like, I don't know. They've four games just pretty quickly. Everyone assumed the Heat were going to move on. Even if the Pacers were the higher seed, technically kind of like last year, how this everyone assumed the Celtics would move on. They probably don't want to be the team that is an assumed sweep in the first round.
Yeah. And look, if it, another thing, and I get what you're saying that like the it's totally embarrassing, but they, you know, they had the excuses built in. No one expected them to win all that. They also got swept last year by yeah. the Celtics who were, you guys beat them, right? The Sixers beat them in the semis last year, right?
No.
Who did they lose to?
We are 1-8 in our last 9 playoff games.
Ah, excuse me. Who did they lose to? They lost 4. Oh, the Bucks. Duh. I'm stupid. they got swept last year too.
And I would like to live in a world where the Sixers had made a conference finals.
Yeah, pardon me for that. They got swept the year before that, and then 2 years before that, they got swept again. So 3 of his 4 playoff appearances were sweeps. So even if individually each one is kind of justified, I think the collective embarrassment possibly from even people above Kevin Pritchard is like, come on. Like, you can't win one game when you're the higher seed or like, okay, I get it. Like, we don't have Depot against the Celtics, but like, you can't, you know, we spent money this offseason on Tyreke Evans and Doug McDermott. You can't win one game, you know what I mean? Like, especially after they almost beat LeBron. I think that just a culmination of all that, even if the extension was legit, like they picked up the team option, full intention of thinking he would come back. I think that just to go get pounded by 50 points in 4 games against the Heat was just, I mean, it was time. And especially if McMillan himself said that he couldn't take the team any farther, he should be let go, you know, put it all together. It was time.
Well, talking about how the Sixers and the Pacers both failed pretty spectacularly in the first round of the
playoffs. Hey, injuries are baked really heavily into both failures, though. Today.
Fair. Although I'm a little lower on Sabonis than most, but that's, I don't think.
Oh, they would definitely not have beaten the Heat if he was around, yeah. But they definitely would have won a game or two if he was around.
The thing is, though, now both the Sixers and the Pacers, probably the Sixers a little bit more than the Pacers, but both teams are having a lot of, like, there's being thrown in a lot of rumors or for, like, they could trade player X for this, or this, these are the moves they need to make to try and move up from, move up to true contender status in the East. And what, like, what is your read on what's going on with the Pacers, especially the Victor Oladipo situation? There's been a lot of news about that. Maybe he wants out of there, but then him pushing back on that. There's always some, with having two pretty much centers in Miles Turner and Domantas Sabonis, and after Sabonis had his breakout year this past year, that maybe Miles Turner, they might be looking to move him. Like, what's your read on that situation, and what do you think is the are the best moves the Pacers can make to try and make themselves better next year?
I talked about the Depot situation a lot, so I should have this down by now, but I kind of evolve the way I talk about it every time. I kind of just throw my hands up, right, because, you know, stemming back to July 1st, whatever, he's in Indy, and they're prepping for the bubble, and he's practicing, and the team is like, you know, we're gonna get down to Orlando, and he's going to practice there, and we'll figure out from there if he's going to play. And that all sounds great. And then Oladipo's like, nah, I'm going to tell Shams that I'm not playing. And no one had any idea that was coming, including the Pacers. And then he did play and followed the original plan that the Pacers had. So that was really weird, you know? And there's already been, like, some reporting in the past about potentially there was, like, a small fracture in their relationship right after his injury, and it's maybe healed a little but not all the way. But, you know, there were no indications that all of a sudden that Oladipo's relationship with the Pacers wasn't that great. And then he played, and he didn't play awesome, but he played. And then, you know, the Athletic report comes out that he is looking to move on, and then he goes on Fat Joe's Instagram Live, which, again, why do I keep having to say Fat Joe's Instagram Live? I cover basketball, but and refutes that, and says his priorities is money and winning, which seem to kind of contradict each other in context of the Pacers. And then they hire their new coach, Nate Bjorkgren, on Tuesday, and he texts Nate Bjorkgren the same day he's hired and is like, let's go, can't wait to work with you. And he's, like, enthusiastic on the team Zoom call and all this stuff. And it's impossible to get a read on this guy. I'm just kind of shrugging at every turn, and I can't trust anything that he says or that is said about him at this point, because even the reporting about him ended up being wrong. He changed his mind, right? So I have no idea. What I kind of know is that he has not requested a trade via the Pacers. So that's a thing. And I don't know that he necessarily wants to be traded. I think he could want to play for a different team next year, but I don't think he necessarily is going to request a trade. And I think the Pacers would be smart to not trade him until the trade deadline, because his value is terrible right now. So his situation is super odd, because so much has happened between his injury and now. But the biggest factor in any Oladipo situation going forward is that he's just kind of not good right now. And with Turner, nothing reported suggests that he wants out. He hasn't said he wants out. But when you have two good centers that take up a lot of your cap, the natural conversation is, okay, you should keep one and trade the other. And Sabonis is better, so eventually, yes, they will have to trade Turner, whether that's this summer, next summer, this trade deadline, who knows. He's been in rumors for 3 years, so I can't get a good read on that one either. But, yeah, there are justifiable reasons to move both of those guys and shake up the team, but also seems like the new coach has talked to both of them, so we'll see what happens.
The Pacers have two good centers that take up their cap, whereas the Sixers have three power forwards, and one of the, and two of them might not be good, and they're taking up most of the cap.
Let's go. Jay Rich for Depot. What's the trade there? Are we done? Is that it?
Would the Pacers take that?
I kind of doubt it. I don't know, though. Yeah, his value is really low, like really low. So I don't know.
I don't think the cap mechanisms would work for that either.
Oh, yeah. Jay Rich only makes like $14 million. I forgot about that.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's and he could be really, like, he could come back next year and be awesome, and that's part of why I think they should keep him until the trade deadline. But I just think his value is so low that, exactly, the fact that I'm even thinking, like, oh, get Josh Richardson more, like, that would be cool. So it's hard. Yeah, it's really hard to kind of, and I feel bad for the front office, because they have to think about all the stuff I just said as a reporter, but they also have to think, like what's the way a Depot trade works out for the Pacers? Like, how do they get the, like, good value for him given his injury, and he doesn't turn out awesome for his next team? Like, the odds that they look good in any Depot deal is like 5% maybe, so I do not envy their position.
So speaking, you mentioned Turner and that whole situation. We wanted to bring a little Sixers positivity into this, so I know Daniel had some Embiid-Turner matchup data he wanted to throw your way.
Oh no.
Yeah. So,
no. I thought this was optimism.
Well, it's optimistic for us.
Turner is embarrassingly bad against the Sixers. He even flipped off the crowd. I've never seen him have that kind of passion before.
Yeah, so there are some centers who give Embiid trouble. Mark Gasol comes to mind, always just been able to hang with him. Other centers like Andre Drummond, I think Zach Lowe described it as he feels bad for Andre Drummond whenever he plays Embiid. Like, he's a young child. He wants to come help if they've scraped their knees. He says Andre Drummond just gets bullied by Embiid every time they play. But Miles Turner, well, maybe not that bad against Embiid, has not done well against him. I got these stats from landofbasketball.com, just some basic Embiid versus Miles Turner stats. And they're 10 matchups against each other. The Sixers are 6-4, pretty basic. The stats they put up, Embiid has put up 28 points per game, about 13 rebounds per game, 3.5 assists, 1.5 steals, about 2 blocks. Turner, on the other hand, is only 8 points, 5 rebounds, half an assist, 1 steal, and just under, a little under 2 blocks.
Do you have that in front of you right now?
Yes.
Okay, do they have fouls on there?
Yes, I'm getting...
Turner's at what, 5.9?
I'm going to get to that. Yeah.
Okay, sorry.
I'm going to get that. So Miles Turner has not outscored... He has not outscored Joel Embiid in any of their 10 games thus far. And in rebounds, they have tied once, and Embiid has out-rebounded him the other times.
Okay.
In blocks, they have tied 4 times. Embiid has beaten him in blocks, like, 4 in 4 of their matchups. Miles has only got 2, despite probably Miles Turner being racking up a few more blocks per game in, like, other matchups than Joel Embiid does. He's a bit more of a shot blocker. Their free throws they have had in those 10 games. Embiid is 85 for 112 from the free throw line in games where he plays against Miles Turner. Turner is only 17 for 26. And then in those 10 games, Miles Turner has fouled 45 times. He has fouled out twice, both the first and the 10th game. And there was only one game in which he had fewer than 4 fouls against Joel Embiid.
So we on Locked On Pacers, every Sixers Pacers game, we're like, all right, get Goga ready. Miles is fouling out. Like, obviously Embiid is really good and is, like, the ultimate of this type of player. But any, like, bullyish, strongish center, Turner's just not that good against. Like, Montrezl Harrell just pushes his ass under the basket. Like, Andre Drummond, guys like that. Any kind of finesse big, like Vucevic, Turner can hang with that guy. He's obviously great, like you just said. The blocking, the rotation from the weak side, the pick and roll defense, all phenomenal stuff. There's a reason he gets... you know, good defensive recognition from players and coaches around the league, but Joel Embiid just kicks his ass every time. It's like, and that's part of the reason that I just never want a Sixers-Pacers matchup in the playoffs, because the Sixers would easily win, because one of the Pacers' 5 best players is out of the game for 30 minutes because he just can't contain Joel.
Well, no, see, I don't know if I agree with that, because T.J. Warren might average 50 points a game, like, against the Sixers.
Warren played amazing in every game against the Sixers this season. Like,
tell us.
That first game that the Sixers won, I think November, December, I forget. Yeah, I already said it, but yeah, he's like 15 for 18, and Brogdon was really good, but Turner did not play well, and they lost. Oh my gosh, 4.5 fouls. I never actually looked into the specifics, because... Yeah, I remember that one of my favorite memories covering the Pacers is when Al Jefferson put Embiid in a blender. And the only reason Al Jefferson was playing in that game is because Turner had like 4 fouls already in the second quarter.
Yeah, there was one game I found in particular, February 3rd, 2018. And the Pacers actually won this game 100-92. But in that game, Embiid finished with 24 points, 10 rebounds, 3 assists, 2 steals, 1 block, 7 turnovers. But Miles Turner, on the other hand, in about 20 minutes, 0 points, 3 rebounds, 2 assists, basically just did nothing the whole game.
See, those are those games where the boomers come out and they're like, he's such a bad rebounder for a center. Like, oh my gosh, we need to trade him for any breathing tall person. I'm like, oh my God. It's excruciating. But it makes me feel a little better that, like, it happens to Drummond and other good players. But yeah, Embiid just kicks Turner's ass. I did not enjoy that optimistic section as much as you guys did.
Yeah, we need, after the TJ Warren and you stole TJ McConnell
that's
talk,
fair, that's
we needed one in our column.
But yeah, how have we not talked about the Pacers having 3 TJs, which is by far one of my favorite things in the league. Although TJ Leaf might be the worst rotation player in the NBA.
He's not a rotation player.
Mario Hazonia.
I'm going to stop you there. He's not a rotation player.
I just remember against the Sixers, he was a disaster.
That's not unique to that Sixers game. He is a disaster of a basketball player, yes. He will be playing for some European team at the end of next season. If he even survives next season. He already has a guaranteed deal because of his rookie deal, but yeah, he's bad. All right, what was the other thing you were about to throw in?
I wanted to mention Brogdon. I kind of wanted to talk about that because he was a guy a lot of Sixers fans wanted the front office here to go after last summer. And I wanted your just kind of take on what you saw from him in the first season. I know his creative responsibilities took a big leap forward. He averaged a career high in assists, and as a result, his shooting also dropped off a lot. Do you think he can kind of get back to his prior percentages? Not quite 50, 40, 90, but, you know, better than this was last season while still being more of a lead ball handler type?
And you just summed it up pretty well. That was pretty good. Yeah, I mean, so it was kind of obvious before the season. He's not going to be 50, 40, 90, right? He's playing point guard now. He has to pass and create and draw the attention of defense and all that. Sure, okay, whatever. His percentages will go down. But they were like not – I think it's like 42, 33 or something like that.
They were really bad. I was surprised.
They're real low. Free throws are still good. But so from the start of the season to – I'm just making up a date. Christmas, maybe a little bit before Christmas. He didn't get hurt that much, and he was really good. Like when All-Star voting started, I forget the exact date of that. But they, you know, I thought the most likely all-star on the Pacers was Brogdon, not Sabonis, right? He was that good up to that point. So then he gets hurt a few times and just never recovers into form. And I'm not blaming injuries for the way he played. I'm treating it the way you just said it. He had way more creation responsibilities and other, you know, early in the season, other teams can't scout him as a creator. And then all of a sudden teams are like, okay, here's what he's going to do. Bada bing, bada boom. He can't do anything. And he was still good, you know, like 16 and 6 or 7 or whatever he ended up averaging. He was a good player, like the absolute highest end non-all-star level starter you can have, but the percentages took a big dip, and the thought a lot of the time was like, oh, when Depot's back, then those will naturally come up. But then Depot was also terrible, and those numbers did not come up at all. So I'm confident they can come up a little because I think a new coach will have the offense not take as many bad shots like mid-rangers all the time that McMillan loved, and Brogdon takes a healthy amount of mid-rangers last year. So I think just naturally his like efficiency will go up. And I think that if the new coach, you know, gets the ball in Warren's hands more, runs through, I mean, Sabonis had the ball a trillion times per game last year, but just Warren gets the ball more often, pressure will be off of him to create as much. I think his percentages will definitely go up next year, but his usage might go down a little. So his stats might maintain about the same, go down a little bit, but he's definitely a good point guard. You know, he can create for himself and others at a healthy rate, good defender, amazing community guy, like great for the team. Just it's kind of interesting evaluating a guy going from the perfect third banana for Giannis and Chris Middleton to, okay, like you're our best creator now, go do stuff. And it's like, wait, what? You know, so still a good player. I think he's just a little bit overcast right now. And if Depot returns and is able to have the ball more and they run through Warren more, you know, who knows exactly how they handle touches next year. But assuming, and I think this will happen, that his usage goes down a little bit, I think he'll look a lot better next year.
Yeah, that's kind of like Tobias Harris in the 2019 playoffs basically being a spot-up corner shooter to 2020. They don't bring back Jimmy Butler and they tell Tobias Harris, hey, can you be Jimmy Butler now? So.
Well, it could be worse. You could have traded two first-round picks and Landry Shamet for him. Then it'd be
That was deserved after we brought up the Embiid Miles.
That was right below the waist. I'm sorry, that was me.
I do miss Landry Shamet. I miss.
He could dribble, pass, and shoot. I mean, kinda.
The dribbling was coming, but.
Fair, understood.
So, would you at this point in time, would you say you would do the Brogdon sign and trade again?
Yep, definitely.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, because, well, ugh, okay, so they did it before the extension of Sabonis, but knowing now that they're going to have Sabonis for 4 years, like, yeah, get a good point guard for that same time frame, and they fit well together, they play well together when they're on the court. Yeah, absolutely, I would do it again.
Okay.
I would decidedly not do some of the Sixers' 2019 offseason moves again.
Yeah, there are some head. Basically, everything outside of the rookie extensions, I've been like, really? Okay, interesting. Trying to make sure I didn't miss anything good there. See, like, when they did the Jimmy Butler sign and trade, I was like, oh, cool, Josh Richardson's good. That's cool. He did not turn out to be as good as I thought in that move. But
yeah, that got spun really well because it made sense at the time. Oh, Jimmy was going to leave anyway, so at least we got Josh Richardson for him, when people were kind of like convinced, oh, Jimmy, he'll go to LA and they won't get anything. So getting Josh Richardson seemed really good. But then in hindsight, it's like Jimmy wanted to go to Miami. We facilitated that,
right?
Instead of just making him the legitimate offer to come back and run it back with him and JJ. And, you know, it's all hindsight, obviously, but everything just looks disastrous. And
yeah, in the moment I thought, you know what? They stole Al Horford away from the Celtics. He can fill up their bench center minutes when Embiid's out. Great move, 76ers. Yikes. I am not a smart person, is what I learned that day.
Well, we'll have to hope that Peter Dinwiddie helps out make better decisions in the future.
He can swindle some team into taking one of Harris Horford, hopefully.
Well, if those Boomer Pacer fans who hate Miles Turner want to watch some good rebounding basketball team that sends four guys into the paint at the same time, they are welcome to watch the Sixers and listen to us. But Tony, you've got another podcast to record here in a little bit. We don't want to keep you too long, so I think we're going to wrap it up here. Plug whatever you got to plug before we close this out.
I tweet all my stuff, so all in one place, at TEastNBA on Twitter if you want to read Pacers stuff or hear my voice in other places. But I cannot imagine wanting to hear my voice more than maybe 30 minutes a day. So I understand if people do not want to pursue that. But, yeah, that's where all my stuff will be if anyone wants to check it out.
Well, I certainly enjoyed hearing your voice for the past 45 minutes. This was a fun
conversation. I did not mean that as a slight to the length of our conversation.
No.
Sorry.
We've taken too many jabs at each other in this podcast. I understand that.
I'm never getting invited back, am I?
The Sixers and Pacers, like, well, not rivals, are competing for the same relative goal, but, you know, we're the two teams that got bounced. We got to work together.
Yeah, yeah. We got to – collectively, the Heat can be taken down if the Sixers and Pacers team up their powers.
Hopefully the over on Sixers-Pacers playoff wins is – above 0.5 next year.
That's all going to be in the Sixers' hands, honestly. I mean, we're lingering here, but, like, honestly, the way the East is looking, the Pacers are going to be fighting for, like, the 6 or 7 seed, so they're going to have a tough matchup. We'll see.
Yeah. But all right. Thank you so much, Tony, for coming on the show. This is really fun. And, yeah, Sean, I'll talk to you next week.
Yep. Thanks, Tony. Enjoyed the conversation. And, yeah, Daniel, maybe next week we can get into Jameer Nelson as assistant GM of the Delaware squad. But until then, I'll talk to you then.
All right.